This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The avian flu has gotten a foothold on the doorstep of Europe. There are now reports that the H5N1 strain of the virus has been found in birds in Romania and Turkey. The good news is that so far the flu is not spreading from person to person, as far as we can tell, and people can only catch it if they come into close contact with infected birds. But health officials in Europe are poised for a possible pandemic. So what is the U.S. doing to prepare for the possibility of a flu pandemic? What should we be doing? There's been talk of a military-enforced quarantine, and global commerce, which would certainly be affected by any pandemic. So is the private sector worried? We hear a lot about what the government should do and governments are doing and people should be doing. And what is the private sector doing to be prepared? That's we're going to talk about that this hour and other issues. And if you'd like to talk with us, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Michael Osterholm is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. He's also a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. He joins us today. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Osterholm.
Good afternoon, Ira.
You heard on the news before about Europe trying to prepare itself.
Well, in fact, the whole world right now is trying to prepare itself. A pandemic of influenza among humans, unlike that among birds, would spread very quickly across all the continents, and it's something that literally simultaneously we'd be all dealing with.
Well, you had a very interesting article in the journal Foreign Affairs in which you raised some very interesting points that a lot of people are not talking about in dealing with a pandemic, points about the sort of panic that might happen, what companies might be doing.
Well, first of all, as we talked about before on this program, a pandemic of influenza is a new strain of influenza that makes its way from birds, wild birds in many cases, to domestic birds or other farm animals, and not yet capable of readily infecting humans. Occasionally there's what we call kind of a knockoff infection like we've seen 120 sometimes. What we're really concerned about is when influenza then acquires genetically the ability to go readily from person to person, this new strain often has powers that we don't normally ascribe to microbes in terms of routine flu. That's when we get worried, because then you can see a very high number of deaths worldwide. What you were talking about with the Foreign Affairs article is when that pandemic occurs, what happens to the world then in terms of our ability to either provide everyday goods and services, how many people might die, which could be numbers much larger than we've seen anything in this century, and that's what we're really concerned about.
Mm-hmm. You say pandemic planning must be on the agenda of every school board, manufacturing plant, investment firm, mortuary, state legislature, and food distributor in the U.S.
Right. If we were to have another pandemic like 1918, where then in a world population of one-third of what it is now, 50 to 100 million people died. And I might add that the way that this virus kills, even today with what we're seeing in the very limited way in Southeast Asia, our medical care delivery system doesn't have a whole lot better tools to deal with it today than they did in 1918, both in the types of tools and also in terms of just the number of beds and ventilators and certain drugs that we have. So it is not just a scare tactic to say that this could be a 1918-like experience again. That means today we could be talking about anywhere from 180 to 360 million deaths worldwide, which if you think about HIV/AIDS in the last 30 years, as horrible as that has been, it's killed only, and I say only with some pain, about 34 million people. Mm-hmm. And when that happens over a 12 to 18 month period, the scenario obviously begins to play out. The kinds of things that happen in our communities that would be unthinkable start to happen. And that's where we have to then think about how at the local level do we plan for that.
Mm-hmm. You described, speaking of this 1918 pandemic, you described a cytokine storm that happened with the victims of that pandemic. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. When we think of influenza deaths today during the regular winter flu season, many of those deaths occur in people who are basically infirm or otherwise don't have competent immune systems, either the very young or the very old or those with chronic diseases. Those are the ones we typically think of dying. And when they die, they often die from secondary bacterial infections. The influenza virus grows in their lungs, causes damage. It then becomes colonized with the bacteria and they die. Pandemic influenza, particularly certain strains of pandemic influenza, are very different. There have been 10 pandemics over the last 300 years, and we have evidence that in some of the pandemics, what happens is the very strongest of people die, people 20 to 40 years of age, which was what happened in 1918. And the reason that that occurs in part is because the strain of pandemic flu virus, first of all, itself goes through what we call a virus storm. Basically, it grows up to much higher levels in a faster period of time and more cell types throughout the body. When it does that, then the cells of the body tend to want to respond to that immunologically. They want to get the immune system kicked in. And one of the ways that it does that is it releases a chemical called a cytokine. A cytokine is kind of like a smoke alarm for the immune system. And when that kicks in at a very high level, like this virus causes it to do, those with the strongest immune systems in many cases will over-respond. And ultimately, what you die from is actually having this over-vigorous immune response. And so in 1918, for example, in Boston, in a three-month period, 5.7% of all people between the ages of 20 to 40 died. That's what we have our concern today about, because if you look at what's happening in Asia, most of the patients that we've seen in those who have been seriously ill have been basically older children and young adults.
We hear reports on the news that Europe has been stocking up as much as it can on Tamiflu. There was a report today that one Indian company has decided that it has figured out how it could make it on its own, and it might just break the patent that that is on Tamiflu because there's a national or an international emergency. Is that a wise road to go down?
Yeah, well, let's just take a step back, because unfortunately, when you hear the kind of news that we've been talking about over the last several weeks about this pandemic, when I say several weeks, it's been the popular media that's talked about it. Many of us have been on the stump for years trying to alert us to what might come. But we always have this tendency to want to find a silver bullet answer. And Tamiflu has become the Cipro of post-9/11 for the influenza situation. And let me just say that there hopefully will be some very important role for Tamiflu with a type of a pandemic like we're thinking might happen. But a couple of qualifications on that. Number one is Tamiflu, or several other drugs like it in this class of what we call neuraminidase inhibitors, basically suppresses the virus growth. And for normal flu, like the kind we get each winter, it works fairly well. If you take it within 24 to 36 hours after onset, the virus grows at relatively slower speeds in terms of how much it grows in the human body. And this medicine works very well, reducing serious complications and even reducing deaths. And if taken before you're exposed, can actually prevent you from becoming infected. The H5N1 virus, much like what I call its kissing cousin, the H1N1 virus, which, as you know, last week was published in Science, the recreation of that virus from 1918, actually causes this, what I call a virus storm, this very rapid growth quickly once it's in the human body. And we're not sure that Tamiflu will work in the same way for that kind of an event as it does for when you have the regular garden variety influenza. You may have to have it already, as we say, on board. You may have to be taking it before you get exposed. And then, hopefully, at a high enough level in a long enough time period that you can really reduce infection levels. If you don't have that, it may not work well at all. And what I'm concerned about then is the last piece, is that we have such a limited supply of this. Today, the supply chain, the ability to make this, is so limited that even if other companies came on board right now, we're talking about a few percent of the world would have access over the next several years. So in a sense, it's become almost, I think, this somewhat impractical solution to a pandemic. And we have to be very careful about this, as saying you're prepared if you have Tamiflu. If you don't, you're not.
There's no way you could make enough for the length of time you would need to take it and give it to everybody.
Right now, it would be as if I had challenged you 15 years ago to do the Boston Dig in a day. That's about what it would be like. I mean, we're really talking about basically to gear up and scale up. I mean, right now, if Roche were to continue manufacturing and increasing its capacity as they're talking, we could maybe get enough Tamiflu for 20% of the world in about 10 years. That's what we're talking about. And remember, again, I'm raising the question of whether or not it's even going to work effectively in that setting.
Why don't we make a bigger effort if this is a pandemic, and let's say it is definitely a possibility? Why don't we mobilize more, more people, we mobilized during 9/11. We mobilized when we had, the anthrax scare. We started creating all kinds of laboratories to study it. Could we not expand internationally the laboratory capacity to make some more of the Tamiflu?
Well, I think you've hit on a very key point. Every one of the examples you just gave me is we mobilized after the fact. And we as a society tend to do that very well. We'll mobilize after the fact. The point of the matter is that pandemic influenza is not a surprise. As I said, there's been 10 of them in the last 300 years. We know they come. We've been talking about this. But every government of the world, not just our government, every government of the world, as well as private sector organizations, medical societies, even the media, has really neglected this issue. So it tends to get shoved off to the side as we deal with the immediate crisis. I even worry about the media of the last 7 days, which has made this, you know, a front page story or a headline story everywhere, when a pandemic might not occur, and I sure hope it doesn't in the next 6 to 12 weeks, they'll actually let the story die, and then we'll have this almost what I call blowback, or you scared us needlessly, yet knowing that it could be next year or the year after. So the kind of investment we're talking about, though, Ira, is one that is so substantial. It really is a Manhattan-like project situation. And I would add one last piece. One of the concerns I've had this week is what I consider an American-centric response. How can we protect ourselves? How can we take care of the U.S. in terms of vaccine? Today, in this global economy, where so many essential services and products have their start in supply chains or manufacturing plants throughout the world, if we could protect ourselves, the global economy will still collapse, and there will be tremendous collateral damage in this country from a collapsed global economy. So we have to take care of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short break, and hopefully, Michael, you'll come back. We'll talk about what you think we should be doing, because you obviously think we need a really massive effort globally to do this. But we have to take the short break. Stay with us. We'll come back and talk more with Michael Osterholm. Take your calls and talk about preventing, or what do we do in advance of the outbreak of a pandemic. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. We're talking this hour about preparing in advance for any possible avian flu pandemic with Michael Osterholm. He is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, also a professor at the University of Minnesota. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You were saying that one of the great mistakes we could make is if it doesn't show up this year, we have cried wolf and we're not going to be ready for it. If it doesn't show up this year, that gives us some extra breathing room, does it not, to do something?
It absolutely does. And that's, I think, the important message here is that every day that it doesn't happen is just one more day for us to get ready. But like earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis, it will come. And that's, I think, also the important point is that this is not a discretionary kind of situation. It's not one that we could do something to prevent. All we can do is try to reduce the impact of it, and we can hope that it takes longer to get here than tonight.
Mm-hmm. So what should we be doing?
Well, first of all, you have to do what I kind of consider three different efforts simultaneously. Let's assume it happens tonight. We have transmission of this virus between humans in Asia, where it's finally acquired that lock and key kind of genetic picture where now it will transmit readily between humans. If that were the case, we won't have really any impact of vaccine for at least 6 months before we can get some vaccine out of the system. And even then, we're talking about vaccinating well less than 0.5% of the world's population. The drug situation will be similar. We're going to be on our own without any of these. Now what we have to do is we have to plan about how do we get through our everyday lives. Even in the worst-case scenario, where we're talking about a 1918-like experience, we just want to remind everybody that, you know, 98 out of every 100 people in the world will still be around when the pandemic's over, as bad as it will be. So how do you get them food? When we have an international food supply today that will likely shut down many of its processing aspects, its movement aspects, when we shut the borders down, which I believe will happen not even by demand, but people just won't travel. People won't go between countries. How do we do that? How do we get the needed medical supplies? Today, many of our pharmaceutical products in this country, not just those related to flu, come from somewhere else in the world. Again, they have complicated supply chains. well, we have those kinds of drugs, and we already have shortages of them now because of this global just-in-time economy approach. How will we have the other essential services? That's what we have to start planning for now. What are those critical things? I'm not so certain. I worry whether we have televisions or we have jewelry or we have new automobiles, but I sure worry if we have food and medicine and heat for our homes in the northern climates.
Do you think that this rash of natural disasters we've had, starting with the tsunami last Christmas time and all the way up to, you know, the hurricanes and the floods, has made us more aware that we need to do planning or for this, or are we now sort of just planned out? You know,
I think you raise a very important point, and I would say that part of the reason people have finally understood the significance of pandemic flu is because they now realize all the shortcomings that occurred around Hurricane Katrina. But at the same time, as you just said, you know, it's like we can't take another one of these things. How many more can we have? And all I would say is that what is, I think, most telling here is even if you take Katrina, if you take the tsunami, if you take the earthquakes in Pakistan, the vast majority of the world were not affected by those, at least directly. In the United States, 47 different states were able to mount responses to send support to those three states on the Gulf region. The United States government sent their what assets they had. When a pandemic hits, every hamlet, every county, every state, every country in the world will be on their own because it'll be overwhelming over this 12 to 18 month period. So what we have to do is start planning. Will we have enough hospital beds? Of course not. We don't. We have very little surge capacity in our hospital systems now. So where will we care for patients? I believe it'll be gymnasiums, community centers. It'll be trying to get healthcare workers who won't have a vaccine, who won't have a mask, because we'll run out of masks quickly. They too are part of that global just-in-time economy supply chain, and we won't have drugs. Mm-hmm. And so, how are we going to convince our healthcare workers to go to work? This is the kind of planning we have to do locally right now.
But Dr. Osterholm, I heard this. This is almost like deja vu all over again, from when we had the anthrax attacks and the fear and the planning that went on. You know, in case it happened in other communities. How much planning did we get done after that?
And actually, we did do some planning after that that was very directed towards that kind of an event. And again, this is the kind that, unlike an anthrax attack, which would be a one-time kind of event, a city gets mm-hmm. hit now, you're in recovery just like you are with a hurricane, with a much more limited footprint where everyone in the world will be able to come and help you out. This is just all I'm pointing out is very different. We're all in this together at the same time with this one. Mm-hmm. So when Secretary Leavitt says there's going to be 5,000 wars being fought out here at the same time, he's absolutely right. That's true, and that's what we have to understand now. So that's what our planning has to take into account. Will mm-hmm. we have the food? Will we have something as simple as how we handle the dead today? All of us, I think, were extremely upset and distraught over what we saw in the handling of some of the bodies in New Orleans. You know, how we handle our dead says a lot about a society. When we do it with dignity and respect and timeliness, that's important. With a pandemic influenza situation where up to 1.9 million Americans could easily die from this situation, we don't have a system in place today to handle that. In, you know, 1969, the last pandemic we had, the average time from a casket being made till it was in the ground was about 6 months. Today it's about 2.5 weeks. If you look at our crematorium services in this country, they're just not there. So now is the time to start planning so that we can handle that. And that's what, unfortunately, we're distracted by when we just keep concentrating on do we have enough Tamiflu or not. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need our communities to actually start doing. And they can do something about that. When people ask us, what can we do about this? I can't tell you personally to do a whole lot. Maybe you can stockpile some food. You know, whether Tamiflu will work, I don't know. But you can ask your local leaders. You can demand your local leaders. What plans do we have in place for this kind of a situation?
1-800-989-8255. Darlene in Boise. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. First time ever I've called into a talk show, and I've called in because I'm upset. I'm upset about these scare stories that keep coming out that seem so unsubstantiated. The bird flu particularly, my understanding is that there have been 60 deaths within 3 years. We have that many in drive-by shootings in my town. The people who have died, my understanding is that they worked with the birds. There's nothing to say that we're going to have a pandemic. It reminds me of the flu way back when President Ford, and that turned out to be...
Swine flu.
Pardon me?
The swine flu we had.
Yeah, that's right, swine flu, and that turned out to be unsubstantiated. Reminds me of the orange alerts we had forever, and like you said before, the anthrax scare, which turned out to be nothing. And then they're talking about the military, you know, to quarantine us, for heaven's sakes, making this into such a big thing, when particularly when we don't know yet about the possibility of it jumping between species. It's so far ahead and scaring us. And the other fact is that I do not trust vaccines. They're still using mercury. And you start to wonder if this is for the benefit of something, mm-hmm. certainly not us, like maybe the drug companies or something. Mm-hmm. Well, why is there so much fear being promoted?
Doctor, let me get an answer. Doctor,
well, I think this call is not atypical of a number of people wondering, you know, what does this all really mean? And again, you know, this is like the old argument, well, there hasn't been a hurricane in New Orleans in 100 years. Why are we worried about the levees? You know, it's that sense that because it hasn't happened, it won't. Well, in fact, pandemic influenza is like hurricanes or earthquakes. They will happen. They do happen. As I said, there's been 10 of them in the last 300 years. You can go back all the way to antiquity they occurred. And there were certain warning signs that we could look at before these have happened. In this case, the caller is absolutely right. There has only been limited transmission, 120-some cases, 60-some deaths in Southeast Asia that we know of. But what's happened is this virus has continued to change over the course of the past 6 years to one where it is now very closely related to the kind that could easily be transmitted between humans. That's what's happened in the past. You know, this caller doesn't have to just look at what it could be in the future. Go back and read about 1918. John Barry, an author who wrote a wonderfully painful book to read, but a wonderfully written book on the 1918 pandemic. If this person, the caller today, was all aware that the research that we have in the last months shows that there are many parallels between how the 1918 virus came out of the bird population, got into humans, just like H5N1 is now doing. Even to the extent the way the virus is structured, how it basically acts inside the body is very similar. So this is not just some theoretical kind of situation. And of course, you know, if we wait until the day it hits to get prepared, it'll be like trying to appropriate a new budget item for the levees of New Orleans, you know, hours before the hurricane hits the shoreline. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work.
Darlene, you've known about the 1918 pandemic, I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't live through it, but yes, I know about it.
It killed 50 million people?
Yes.
And then just this few weeks ago, they discovered, by an incredible amount of biochemistry, they actually recreated the virus from dead body specimens and showed that it was very much like this one.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make you fearful?
No, because I think it's good that they would be planning and have a plan in place. I'm not saying that. That's good. But I don't know that they should be saying pandemic at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at the point where I do not trust my government. I do not trust, like I said, pharmaceutical companies. So it sort of leaves you like where to go. And as far as like the levies, they did know about the levies and were asking to fix that, but got no money to do mm-hmm. that.
Darlene, that's exactly where we're at right now. I'm not part of the government, and I can tell you that many of my colleagues around the world are not part of the government. We are basically academic researchers who it's our job to save lives. We're at the front lines of public health, and all I can tell you is that this is our best professional judgment, that this is not a matter of if, it's a matter of when and where. And we can't be any more clear about that. You know, I wrote a book that was published on 9/11 of 2000 called Living Terrors, 1 year before the day. And in that, I talked about the World Trade Center towers and the Al-Qaeda. And if you had asked me in that year between 9/11 of 2000 and 9/11 of 2001 what the chances are of the World Trade Center towers being attacked, and when I had talked about it, I said, I don't know, 1 in 10,000, somewhere in there. I don't know what it is, but it's that kind of a risk. You got to deal with it. I am telling you as a scientist with 30 years training, this is a one. This is going to happen. The question we can't answer right now is how bad it will be, when it will happen, or where it will start. But we can tell you it is going to happen. And I don't know of any other thing in science that I can say with almost as much certainty, except that also one day we're all going to die. You know, and hopefully it's many, many, many decades from now. But
you understand, though, also my reluctance. For example, the Center for Disease Control that covered up research regarding Merck and its medications. And there's so much corruption with departments going on.
Well, let me just say, I think this, Ira, is an interesting discussion. Mercury is a whole other topic.
Yeah.
I can only say my colleagues at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are some of the very finest in the world. I have the most respect for them, and they are lifelong researchers and scientists who will tell you the same thing that I'm telling
right.
you.
Darlene, thank you for calling. Michael, we're going to have to come back and have you back and talk about the next step, which we didn't get into because we got into such good conversation, and that is, can we make a vaccine fast enough with newer techniques than we have today than using the eggs that they do? Or there are newer techniques.
We have to do that,
yeah.
and I'll be happy to come back, Ira.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and a policy professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. Thanks for being with us today.